Kincaid. Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, DRW.net, and net on.
Howdy!
Minutes past the hour. Welcome to Moran Monday on the Horn. And I'm sure it's like crazy here. So is misbehaving, hearing probably every word. Hopefully it'll it may computer to God knows what. I don't know. It appears to have settled down for the time being. And plus, I can't that it's that way. It is now. And this week, dug a little. You know, it was a tiger trap or anything. Hole, you get an ankle steadily. And hopefully we'll crawl out quicker, sooner rather than later. And we've got some help in doing so. We were at 109. We needed to raise, we're around $300 we need to raise tonight. And like I said, we got help on that. Goaded from Texas. At room moderator, educate Jewish long anywhere. Family, a new job. A die want, a good school, middle school English as a second language, full time, and a out for pizza. Bought myself a few teacher blouses, and I'm sending $100 to the Horn. What can you do to celebrate my new job? Smile in my general direction, support public education and teacher unions, then send a contribution to the Horn. May want to match $100 if fine here on the Horn. And it is much appreciated. Thank you ever so very much, Betsy. And congratulations on the new job. So, you know, 10 at 10, at 54, 25, 20, badly needed because, like I said, you know, and we're trying to stay out. You can hurt yourself in those things. Program notes, we are fast approaching September, and September is going to be a very busy time, and I'm going to be on the road a whole bunch. Just an advance warning. I wish there were folks who could flip looking at actually below fundraising goals because when the program is not live, so that's me on the road to Wisconsin, and I'm really excited about my first ever trip to Texas. Thanks to this of the heading to Waco the week after I get back from Wisconsin. It's really quite exciting. And more travel later in the month, but I will be home for the middle of September. Just a little bit of advance warning. And then, of course, this weekend, there will be no show on Friday. There will be no program on Friday. Because we can drive to mountaintop removal up there. Hopefully the buffering will settle down. Thanks, Marty, for letting me know. Let's see. Well, you know what day it is, right? Yeah. Just real quick, like, if I can get the computer to cooperate, which it doesn't seem to be wanting to do. A note in from Ron and Raleigh. Ron and Raleigh sent this along a little bit before airtime, and I think it's a fair question. He notes that the sentencing for two military men will come down in the next couple of days. Bradley Manning, who exposed the murder of journalists by a helicopter gunship crew, which led to no punishment for the murderers, and Robert Bales, a sergeant that went on a murder spree that led to the deaths of 16 Afghans. Ron asks me, and you all, would you like to wager on who gets the stiffer sentence? The short answer to that is no, I would not care to make that wager. Because we know who's going to get the stiffer sentence. Bradley Manning is going to get the stiffer sentence. He made a sincere plea for some kind of leniency. I read it earlier today. He says, I made mistakes. He says, I realize now that in the midst of everything that was going on in my life, I should have gone through better channels, and I should have done it better, and I should have done it the right way. One does not know how that is going over today with libertarian ophthalmologist fan Julian Assange. The Bales guy slaughtered 16 Afghans. I would be surprised past surprise if the guy did 10 years in the brig for it. Things do seem to be settling down on the buffering front, though, so hopefully we'll get the program going nicely here shortly. But at any rate, you know what today is. Yes, it's the 19th of August, I'm well aware. But far more than that, it is Moran Monday on the Horn. Hurry, 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 step right up. You can't tell the Morans without a program, and this is the program that tells the Morans you just can't tell them much. For less than 5 cents an hour of programming, you can go behind this thin cybernetic veil of canvas and witness the bizarre, the obscene, the shocking, the stupid of the right wing. And occasionally there are other displays inside the Moran Monday tent. We advise men and women to hang on to wallets and purses as well as little children, as the Morans can get grabby. Head for the hills, and you'll be up to your armpits in Morans. Oh, and you will. You will. We've had bumper crops on Mondays lately. You know, it's kind of weird because August is supposed to be the slow news month when everybody bugs out of Washington. Well, apparently they went somewhere else and just decided to keep being weird. Or twisted or sick. Yeah. And I was pretty content with the lineup that we had just shortly before airtime. But then I ran across a couple of things that made me feel like I really needed to review the pecking order, if you will. Yeah. You remember, perhaps, do you happen to remember Scott Desjarlais, teabagging member of the House of Representatives from Tennessee stand? Scott Desjarlais, who used to be a physician, who's all kinds of pro-life except for when he's having sex with one of his patients. And it turns out that, you know the drill, right? Do as I say, not as I do. My moral imperatives apply to you and not me. Yeah, that's Scott Desjarlais. Well, old Scott was having himself a little old town hall meeting when he took a question. From an 11-year-old little girl. The question was about her daddy. Daddies mean a lot to 11-year-old little girls. Daddies mean a lot to children generally. Oh, but mercy. Scott Desjarlais, well, not for him. And of course, 11 years old, 4 years old, right? Sure.
What? Thank you.
Now, hold on a minute. I'll play in case the audio, and it, well, and it wasn't the best quality. Often it is not. The little 11-year-old girl says, I'm documented, but my daddy isn't. I have a daddy who is undocumented. What can you do to help him be able to stay with me? This is her congressman. It's the pin. But it is. Here then, the
thank you for coming forward and sedating. Appreciate you coming forward and asking your question. The answer is still kind of ringing that we have to follow those laws, and you know, that's where we're at.
The little girl's father presently loves her. And Scott Desjarlais just says, little girl, we got some laws here, and we're going to get rid of you, daddy. And I swear, in all his crassness, all his uncouthness, all his outright meanness, neither early Kyler nor Dan Halen could be half as crappy as Scott Desjarlais was to an 11-year-old little girl. He is her congressman. He could have at least said, I'll look to it. We got some laws and we're going to have to follow them. Now, if she'd been a little white child, yeah, maybe different. I wish I could do something about the buffering. But there's not a lot I can at the moment. Let me try one thing. Old computers. But the thing that speaks to me out of that clip more than anything, Scott Desjarlais, defender of life and fornicator with patience, has to say is the clapping in the room. Remember back during the pageant season for when a whole bunch of repiglickins were trying to keep the Romney bot from becoming their party's nominee to go and get squished? And a whole room full of perhaps thousands of repiglickins clapped wildly at the prospect of letting people simply die on emergency room floors. They clapped for it. They loved it. They were kind of, well, turned on by it. Well, this is that all over again. Not that you were really expecting they would have, but they haven't changed. Not an iota's worth. Not a bit. No, sir. Not a sausage. They clapped at the idea of sending that 11-year-old little girl's daddy as far away from her as is really humanly possible. And under the circumstances, whether that be Mexico, Tierra del Fuego, Johannesburg, or Perth, it little matters. Because in the grand scheme of poverty-type situations, a miss, as they say, is as good as a mile. So clap, you teabaggers. Clap, you Tennessee teabaggers that claim to value life and claim to have family values. Well, you know, as long as it's a nice white family. Right, teabaggers? As long as it's a family that fits within the confines of whatever it is that you deem to be sufficiently American. Yes, of course. I remember one time when, oh, who was it? Indiana half pint, Mitch Daniels, said he would be in favor of getting away from some of the more contentious social issues that make the can seem so bleak. Of course, then again, at war with, after all, Taliban. But the teabaggers and the friends of Jeebus and the evangelicals wanted absolutely nothing to do with it. And six stories in today's Monday are stories of so-called social conservatives and the lengths to which they will go to impose their hateful vision on the rest of us who want nothing to do with it. So I tell you what I'm going to do. We're going to stop and do a full-on restart and come back and, well, restart the whole shooting match, I guess. That's probably a bad phrase. So stand by. It might take 5 minutes or so, but we are. We're going to restart. Be right back. All right, so let's try this again. Hopefully things will be a little bit more stable this time through. It is Moran Monday on the Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. It's 26 minutes before the hour. I apologize for the interruption, but old and tired equipment, right? Sure, why not? Let's see what emails rolled in while I was gone. Oh, well. Anyway, running through the nominations. This one actually goes back 3 days. This is from, what, Saturday's? Fridays. Friday's edition of the Mark Levin show. And Mark Levin is always good for a Moran Monday nomination because, A, he's a Moran. Two, he's got a voice made for print. And thus I understand that listening, it being subjected to an audio clip from him, is probably more than a little bit of a chore. But still, this deserves a listen. Like I said, it was like some sort of Moran freak show, social conservative, right-wing free-for-all this weekend. And it started on Friday with this creep. Come on, Mark. Bring it. Bring the wing nuttery, Mark. Here, Mark. Come on, boy. Wing nut freak out. Come on. You can do it. Oh, for heaven's sakes.
I saw this on the Drudge Report, Fox News. Abortion coverage for Congress under Obamacare. Now, what are they aborting now? It's an issue lawmakers may not want to have to explain at town hall meetings back home. An attempt to fix a problem with the new health care law has created a situation in which members of Congress and their staffers could gain access to abortion coverage, something that currently is denied to federal employees who get health insurance through the government's plan. Abortion opponents say the administration needs to fix it. Abortion rights supporters say the concern is overblown.
That's overblown. I mean, yeah, it's like the NSA thing. What are we talking about? 3,000 dead babies? What's the big deal?
Wait, huh? I was trying really hard to just let this clip go. It's like the NSA thing is overblown. You know, 3,000 dead babies. What? No, really, what? Has there been some new revelation out? Has libertarian Eddie Snowden and libertarian Greenwald declared that the NSA has killed 3,000 babies? What? Because I think that's what he said. All right. No. Just let F. Lee Levin, as Flimball used to call him, let the freak talk. Come on.
Healthcare law has created a situation in which members of Congress or staffers could gain access to abortion coverage, something that currently is denied to federal employees who get health insurance through the government's plan. Abortion opponents say the administration needs to fix it. Abortion rights supporters say the concern is overblown.
That's overblown. I mean, yeah, it's like the NSA thing. What are we talking about? 3,000 dead babies? What's the big deal? There's 310 million people. What's 3,000?
Now, the abortion complication is a new headache for the... No, it's not. It's not a headache for the administration at all. This administration doesn't give headaches. Doesn't have headaches. Gives headaches. The abortion complication is a new headache for the administration as it tries to shoehorn members of Congress and certain staffers into insurance markets coming later this year under Obama's health care overhaul. It's not an overhaul, it's nationalization. An amendment by Iowa Republican, yeah, we know all that. Last week, the White House Office of Personnel Management said the government would keep paying its share premiums for lawmakers and affected staffers who must leave the federal employee health care system by January 1. Now, that eased a major anxiety for several thousand staffers accustomed to getting the same benefits as other federal employees. Yes, we wouldn't want to put them out like the rest of we the people. No, we have to work every day, pay our taxes to these buffoons and make sure that they're fully covered while we have to look around for health care, right? But the proposed regulation put out by the OPM did not explicitly address abortion coverage. Well, of course not. It's the Obama administration. You know, it used to be a chicken in every pot. Well, under this administration, it's an abortion in every household.
He's a clever one, that Mark Levin. If you can listen to him long enough to catch on to the cleverness. There's only one problem. You know, back there where he said, no, never mind, we know all that, and just blew right by? What he was blowing by was the explanation for why this this so-called problem exists. And it goes back to 2009, and some right-wing legislative shenanigans. Because it was during the original discussion of the Affordable Care Act and Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act in 2009 that Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa offered an amendment that forced lawmakers in Congress and their personal staff to use the same insurance exchanges that the rest of America will. You know how Levin said, we're going to have to go shopping around for it. No, that's what the exchanges are for. You're not going to have to go shopping around. It's one-stop shopping. There's the exchange. You look at the numbers. You pick your choice. You're done. But the person who created the problem was Chuck Grassley, because he thought that the Congress would say, well, not heavens to Detroit, get off a nice government. So this plan? Oh, heaven forfend! Except they didn't. The Democrats let Grassley's amendment go on and become law with the rest of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. So, the Office of Personnel Management, charged with obeying the law, said, we're going to continue kicking emails for people who may have to go over to the exchanges with coverage that will begin on January 1st. The exchanges open on October the 1st. Hence, the Mark Levin voice made for print flip out. And under this administration, it's an abortion in every household. If you're lucky, Barack Hussein Obama will come and do the abortion personally. Probably with a Dremel or something. Because, you see, private insurance carriers cannot be banned from offering to insure medical services that are, in fact, already legal. Because, you know, the free market, the unseen hand, and all of that crap that Mark Levin is all for until, you know, he's not, because he is, after all, a moron. It appears that a reboot is absolutely useless, was useless, because we're buffering like wild here, and I apologize for that. But let's just the same. Let us continue to... I know, it's getting difficult to hang on to stories until prayer meeting Wednesday, because the Moranity, these guys have gone pro. And by way of evidence, I offer you Kevin Swanson and Dave Buhner. Buhner. Not Boner. Buhner. B-U-E-N-E. And though it's past Friday, they're still upset about something that happened a couple of months back. To wit, the Boy Scouts. Come on, boys.
Manhood is a problem. And the Boy Scouts, of course, are going to lead the decline now, since the final decision came down that the Boy Scouts, as a national organization, are going to invite homosexuals into the troops.
Which is just a matter until they invite homosexuals, active homosexuals, to be leaders of the troops. Yeah. And pretty soon you're going to have the sodomy merit badge. Christians are fleeing like rats.
Yeah. So after that, I guess it's incest. And then after that, it's... the cannibal merit badge, where I guess you cut up human flesh, fry it there.
But you have to cook it in a Dutch oven out in the wilderness.
Yeah. Okay, so that's what the Boy Scouts are doing. They're trying to add abomination on abomination. Effectively, going into God's Word, trying to find the thing that God really, really, really hates the most. The sins, this Bible, going through the list of sulking merit badge. The Scouts are headed.
See, now I played the clip all the way through. You have no idea how difficult that is for me to do. Because I want to just stop and scream a little bit. Manhood is a problem, and the Boy Scouts are going to lead the decline. What does that even mean, manhood is a problem? Does that mean that, That Kevin Swanson and Dave Buhner are afraid that they can't go out in the woods and fart and scratch themselves and eat their own boogers in God's wilderness, unlooked at by the homosexuals? Oh, I have to go back. I do. I just do.
And the Boy Scouts, of course, are going to lead the decline now, since the final decision came down that the Boy Scouts, as a national organization, are going to invite homosexuals into the troops.
The language. They're going to invite homosexuals into the troops. It's funny because Ferg and I have been doing some practice tests for things like college admission exams. And there's one that we ran across one question where you're supposed to look at a piece of text and there's an underlined phrase and you've got a choice between that phrase is just fine or there's another phrase and that's, B, C, D, E that would make the thing make more sense. And there are lots of ways to make what he was trying to say make more sense. But the goddess of irony was there, and she put the gift of prophecy on him. And he said, invite the homosexuals into the troops. Because these perverted, sick, twisted SOBs cannot for the life of them quit thinking about gay sex. They do not have one iota, they do not have 1 second on Generations Radio to think about something as simple or as complex as love itself, or the trials and tribulations of trying to be in a long-term relationship with another human being, be it a heterosexual or a homosexual relationship. No! They have to go straight to the sex. And the funny thing is, these guys purport to be interpreting God's word. Well, hell, you know what God hates worse than homosexuals in the Old Testament? Gentiles living on Israeli land. Mm-hmm. Gentiles living in the land of the Hebrews, because he tells them several times, you shall not permit them to live. Kill them! Kill them all! Every last one! Kill their animals! Till the fields! I don't want an earthworm living here that hadn't been circumcised. You got it? Kill them all. The Canaanites, the Azarites, the Edomites, the Aboamites, the Jerubites, the... So what these goobers don't understand is that if we're going to sit there and live by the Old Testament, God really hates them a lot. But they're... No. It's all about the gay people.
Which is just a matter until they invite homosexuals, active homosexuals, to be leaders of the troops. Yeah. And pretty soon you're going to have the sodomy merit badge. Christians are fleeing like rats.
And then there's that one. You're going to have the sodomy merit badge, right, because after all, there's a heterosexual fornication merit badge already, right? And the Christians are fleeing like rats. I think if I was a Christian, I would find something besides rats to compare to which to compare my particular weird-ass sect. There's a paycheck involved with all this. Remember, there is a paycheck involved with all this.
Yeah. So after that, I guess it's incest.
Naturally, it's incest. I don't know why they would be upset about incest, because it is all over the Bible, Old Testament. I'm your daughter, I'm your daughter. Squeakity, 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 squeakity. I guess there weren't any bed springs back then, were there?
And after that, it's the cannibal merit badge.
Right, because cannibalism is right after incest in the whole list of crap God hates. Never mind the fact that the sect that these guys belong to is predicated on ritual cannibalism. This is my body, eat it. This is my blood, drink it. Yes, master. You know, as if we're all a bunch of little Renfields running around.
Where I guess you cut up human flesh, fry it there.
But you have to cook it in a Dutch oven out in the wilderness. Yeah.
And I helped. Oh, for pity's sakes. This is something approaching unbearable. Except for the fact that it's Moran Monday. And we kind of have to do this stuff on Moran Monday. Ray writing in, that guy's tense. Tension is a killer. A quote from Kaiser Soze. You really can't go wrong with a Kaiser Soze. You just can't. Oh, what a Moran Monday it is. Next. Just next. And then Marty with an observation. Leading the decline? The Boy Scouts are leading the decline? I thought the churches were blazing the trail down the decline. Well, they kind of always have. I mean, we have the collapse of Roman civilization, and the church largely to thank for that, but never mind. Meanwhile, the freakout continues, especially over at Radio Rwanda, over who's going to go PP where. The obsession continues. Trans children. We had this last week. And we're talking about a member of the California State Assembly by the name of Tim Donnelly. Anybody heard of him? He's a real Lulu. He put in writing, "Many of the parents I have heard from within the last few days have literally pulled their kids out of public schools." That means that, because he used the word literally, that means that even though school isn't in session, parents have gone and not pushed, not taken by the hand and gently led out, but pulled them. Maybe by the hair. I mean, these are, after all, Bible-believing Christians. Literally pulled their kids out of public schools and have enrolled them in homeschool and private school programs. Oh, you mean it's just like when the brown-skinned people got to go to school with the little white children, that it's that all over again? Assemblyman Donnelly? Why, yeah. Wow. That siren must mean it's time for the PC police again. Sure, why not? Over on Radio Rwanda.
Signed a bill last week designed to protect transgender students in the state's public schools, giving each of them the right to choose, for instance, which bathroom they will use and whether they will play boy or girl sports. And while supporters say it will cut down on bullying, which is always good, our next guest predicts it's going to be a recipe for disaster, and he is already pulling one of his kids out of public school because of it.
I wish they'd stop pulling on the little children. That just seems a little bit too much like abuse. But do let's hear from Tim Donnelly.
California State Assemblyman Tim Donnelly joins us right now live from Los Angeles.
He's got American flag pin.
Good morning.
I understand you sat down with your two boys, one's 13, one's 16. They both go to public schools. And what were their concerns about this?
Well, when I first talked to him about it, my 13-year-old just had this horrified look on his face. And he said, "Seriously, Dad?" He said, "That's the stupidest idea I've ever heard." And they expressed real concern over using the bathroom in particular with a girl in the next stall. And you can't blame them. I mean,
we can't blame them. Why not? Somebody, please, explain to me why. Tell me why I can't blame them, because they're worried about there might be a girl in the next stall. Are they going to be overwhelmed with I don't know, rape rays, and Mrs. Schmettelkoffer will just say, "I walked in the restroom and there he was, a rutting on Mayella." Why can't we blame them? I say we should, because I say this is a function of, wait for it, bigotry and ignorance. I mean, if you were a halfway decent father, wouldn't you sit down and say, "Well, wait a minute, okay, son, tell me why you're upset. Tell me what bothers you about this." Instead of saying, "Dang, Skippy, you ain't a-going to that school no more. We're going to homeschool you, boy, and you ain't going to see your friends no more except at church. And by God, I'm going to teach you all about how the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor and the Japanese tried to invade New York and Lewis and Clark discovered Sasquatch."
For some of us to remember when we were teenagers, but your body's going through incredible physiological changes, hormonal changes, and...
Words. Incredible physiological changes. That means physiological changes that are not to be believed. Incredible. Credo, Latin, believe. Incredible. Unbelievable. What? Is Tim Donnelly's son growing calves the sizes of cantaloupes, perhaps? Will he soon be strong enough to hump 75-pound bales of marijuana through the Mexican desert across the border to sap all of our precious bodily fluids? Incredible physiological changes, I tell you.
It's a very confusing time, and you're uncomfortable with yourself.
Sure.
The idea of using the restroom facilities or taking a shower, and showers are pretty
much... Oh, the guy sitting on the dump button over there at Fox Radio Rwanda. I mean, we're talking bathroom stuff here, and he was just micro milliseconds away from click and doing the 20-second delay there. I mean, you're in the restroom and you're taking a shower. Oh, shaving cream.
Wide open, and being naked in front of someone that you might want to ask out.
Wait. Did Tim Donnelly just say that he thought his son might want to ask a transgendered woman, girl, out? That one of those little, you know, one of those little boys who wasn't comfortable as a being defined simply by the presence of a penis on his body and decided to, he wanted to be all purdy and stuff and wear a dress and feel like the girl he is inside, that Tim, because don't you think Tim Donnelly would take his son out back behind the woodshed and whomp him right smart for thinking such a thing? The goddess of irony. She never, never takes a day off. Let's try this again.
Overusing the bathroom in particular with a girl in the next stall, and you can't blame them. I mean, it's hard for some of us to remember when we were teenagers, but your body's going through incredible physiological changes, hormonal changes, and it's a very confusing time, and you're uncomfortable with yourself.
Sure.
The idea of using the restroom facilities or taking a shower, and showers are pretty much wide open, and being naked in front of someone that you might want to ask out, you know, we're talking about children here. We're not talking about adults.
Absolutely, and I understand you've already...
Really? The children are dating out in his district in California now? What, 4, 5, 6, 8? What? You see what they do with an issue? They take a fairly straightforward idea, and then they extrapolate it to its illogical extreme. Well, my son's going to be taking a shower next to a girl that he'd like to ask out. Well, if that's the case, aren't there a lot of issues inherent in that? You see, this isn't about just letting anybody choose the bathroom that they want to use, or no. This is about a specific micro subset of the population, which, as far as I can tell, may actually be larger, according to Tim Donnelly, than any of us had suspected that it was. Hey. But please, Steve Doozy, what's on your mind? Share.
You pulled one of your kids out, the other son, you're going to wait and see what happens. You're holding out that this bill is going to be repealed, right?
Well, yeah, there wasn't a whole lot of coverage of the bill before Governor Brown signed it. But once he signed it, there's been a tsunami of discontent. There are multiple efforts, or at least an effort by multiple groups to repeal it. We have a referendum process here, but you only have 90 days to get 500,000 signatures. But, you know, when you look at this bill, it's a bad idea on so many different levels that it's hard to understand how it's going to help. I don't understand how it's going to help reduce right. bullying when you have a group of kids that, admittedly, even in the LA Times, is maybe 1.5 to 2% of the student population
right.
that identify as transgender.
Yeah, and who
so
cares if they get stomped to death anyway, right?
Or anything.
And so you say that we're making an accommodation for about 2% of the kids while we're violating the rights of 98% of the others.
But is it okay if we ask which rights of the 98% are being violated? The right to... Because one of the groups that is going to go out there and try to get themselves 500,000 signatures in 90 days so this horrifying, terrifying bill can be repealed and rescinded is called Privacy for All Students. The only problem is these dumb right-wing bastards don't believe in privacy for anybody. Because just ask them, they'll tell you. Privacy is cited in Griswold versus Connecticut and, well, Roe v. Wade. Ask any hardcore constitutional originalist friend of Jeebus, evangelical, Bible-believing, conservative Christian, and they'll tell you there's no right to privacy.
Well, and that's what you're doing. If the problem is that you're not comfortable, how is it a solution to make...
This ain't a comfort issue. It's not a comfort issue at all. But don't tell Tim Donnelly.
The other 98% share that same intense discomfort. That's just not logical. Most of the schools, and I think this is really a question of, can the school administrators on site use their discretion as adults to make a private accommodation, which they have, and let students who identify as mm-hmm. transgender to use private bathroom facilities. I would have loved to have a private bathroom when I was in high school.
I'll bet you would have, Tim Donnelly. So, it's 2013. Oh, I wish I could. I wish I could, Texas Betsy. She just said, I would deeply love for you to conjure Peter Godbold. I would love to. Because somewhere I'm sure Peter has read all of this and thrown things at the wall. It's 2013. And nothing good ever happens after I begin a sentence with, it's 2013. It's 2013, and here's a white guy positively glowing in the dark with his white male privilege, calling for separate but equal facilities for transgendered students in California. Lovely, huh? Utterly oblivious to the fact that we'll let them use the teacher's bathroom. Creepy! Creepy! That's creepy. Because you never know, well, you know, this is only applying to public schools, so maybe it's not quite so creepy as having the transgendered student using the private staff facilities and having, you know, Father Whackbottom come in and, hey, kid, you want a Snickers? You get a Coke, too. Right? Ray noting, the faithful should be pitied. But then they effing say something, and all the pity goes right out the window. I sure would have liked to have had a private bathroom when I was in high school. Yeah, I bet you would have, Tim Donnelly. They do, genuinely, truly. really amaze me. And then in the same vein, some right-wingers got hold of a video camera, and that's never a good thing. In this case, it's an organization called the Media Research Center, MRC, and they're all upset about this same law. A person who considers himself a reporter by the name of Dan Joseph, as being reported by Media Matters, starts interviewing people about how they feel about this law as if it was going to apply to them. As we say in the business, let's give a listen.
Hey everybody, I'm Dan Joseph with MRC TV. Now the other day, California Governor Jerry Brown signed a law which would allow students from ages K through 12 to use opposite sex bathrooms if their gender identity was different from their biological sex. So if a teenage boy says he feels like a girl on the inside, he can now go and use the girl's locker room to shower, change, whatever. Now, most people would probably say that this idea is, you know, insane. But we decided to come to a college campus where
most
everybody's
people?
Tolerant and open-minded and see how they feel about this new law. Do you guys think that's an okay law?
I think it's okay if they're feel attracted to, if they're a boy and they feel like a girl, but they're attracted to boys. But I think if they're attracted to girls, then I don't think that that's okay.
I think it would be problematic.
You're right. Okay.
I think it would be a complicated issue.
I don't have a problem with it. I think it's just like how the parents and how the teachers react.
That's a difficult question. I
How do you think your parents would feel about
that? I think my
that?
Parents would not like that.
Okay.
Honestly, I'm not sure if I'd feel comfortable allowing that to go. I think there would probably have to be a third option.
Are you all right with that?
Yeah. I mean, I guess if that's what they have to do.
If the girls are okay with it, if they're, like, yeah. comfortable enough, then it's fine.
Well, would you? You were
I mean, we had one at our school this year, so.
You had a transgender student?
Yes.
Did he shower with you guys?
I wasn't in that locker room, but he used the boys' bathroom.
He used the boys' bathroom.
And he was a girl.
So would you oppose or support some sort of bill like that if it came here to Virginia?
I think I would probably wouldn't support something like that because it forces people to be in bad situations.
I feel that people should be able to express themselves however they want to, and if they feel that's who they are, then that's who they are. But you also have to take in mind the sensitivity of other students and other parents if they don't feel the same way, unfortunately. So I think there has to be like a balance of like allowing them to still be themselves.
Am I missing something here? One, this is taking place on the campus of George Mason University, which is short of Patrick Henry University or whatever it is, or maybe Jerry Falwell University, or maybe Pat Robertson University, one of the most conservative universities in Northern Virginia, or in Virginia. I mean, it's not quite that outfit full of weirdos down in South Carolina. Oh, what's the name of that? Never mind. You know, where the black folk and the white folk, doesn't even matter if they're the right genders, can't be a holding hands. Yeah. But Our intrepid reporter here, what's his name again? And he can't quite get anybody to say, that's insane! Now he starts the whole thing standing in front of a statue of George Mason. And he declares exactly that. Well, I think if we asked most people, they'd say, that's insane! So we're 2 minutes and 10 seconds in, and nobody's really said that. In fact, most of the women being queried, and isn't it interesting that we're talking to women, because why? Anybody want to chime in on that? Why? Why are we talking? Is that because that's who Dan Joseph is more comfortable talking to? Or is it because Dan Joseph has predetermined that women are somehow at greater risk because some transgender male is going to get hit by the rape rays, and you know, there he was, a-rutting on my Mayella, like I said. I'm just... I'm having a hard time sorting this out. Help is appreciated.
As well as respecting the thoughts and minds of others, even though they may or may not agree with it.
I mean, I remember high school kids get away with a lot of bad stuff that a lot of kids nowadays would probably take advantage of rules.
Well, like right, that. You mean like a guy who just wants to see some naked chicks.
Exactly.
Going, oh, I'm transgendered, you know, I need to go to the girls' locker room.
Exactly.
Okay, because they trotted that one out last week, too. I think it was when Megyn Kelly was saying she couldn't get head. And I got to thinking about that later. Let's unpack that dire, dark, foreboding fear of Bible believing Christians that some prankster boy is going to because you know that's one of those things. So I need to use the girls' restroom. Well, okay, Dan. Are you going to spell it D-A-N-I now? Okay, Dan, that's fine. But all he's really trying to do, is get in and see the girls in their underswears. And after he's done it, he's going to come out and say, I done said I was transgendered so I could get in there and see them strutting around on their hooker heels. No, really, I ain't transgendered. No, seriously, I ain't got no bra on. Uh-uh. No. Hell, I don't even... No. I don't even... Really? Really? No, I ain't gonna wear no damn feather boa. Now you quit that. I ain't never, not once have I ever, ever played a Broadway show tune. Now just quit it. Because if the whole boys will be boys and play pranks just to get in and see girls in their underwear and maybe take a shower with them, well, they're equally mean in the opposite direction, and maybe Dan Joseph might want to actually inquire of a transgendered person as to what the bigotry is exactly like once people start saying, ha, look at you. Great googly moogly. You know, because from then on, he's going to be Dan the transgendered guy. And there's not going to be much in the way of getting away from it. Sending a note to Ben Birch here. I can't seem to connect to the stream. My apologies. And the thing is, we're just now approaching the halfway mark.
Excuse me. Hey, are you going into the locker room?
Yes.
My name's Dan. I'm a transgender.
Uh-huh.
So that means I have, you know, the man parts, but inside
sure.
I feel more like a woman.
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering, is it okay if I go in there with you in there and change and shower and stuff? Just because.
Okay, this is where they get cute. Isn't this just precious? he's standing inside a George Mason building in Virginia, which does not have a law like California's, on a college campus, which does to which the California law does not apply, but just the same. This is where they're going to prove that it's insane! Insane! Right? Sure, why not? Well, it looks like everything has died. The internet, the works. My apologies. So, I guess this will be the end of Moran Monday. We'll take a break and find out, and I'll update you here in a second. Okay, so yeah, we're back. This is for the podcast part. Anyway, Dan Joseph is in a white tank T-shirt and I guess some sneakers with black socks and some nondescript gym shorts. That's where we left off.
My name's Dan. I'm a transgender.
Uh-huh.
Oh, you notice how apparently transgendered people have special voices. I don't know if this is like the Dune transgendered voice of control or... Hi, I'm Dan, and I'm transgendered. Because, you know, when that transgendered woman was fighting for our freedom over in the Afghanistan, that's what he sounded like before he came out and started transgendered. Hi, I'm a SEAL. And I'm here to kill the Al-Qaeda? Okay? Right. Because stereotypes, well, that's what it's all about.
That means I have, you know, the man parts, but inside I feel more like a woman. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering, is it okay if I go in there with you in there and change and shower and stuff? Just because I don't really feel like comfortable in the men's area, you know? It's just weird. Is that okay with you?
Do you think it's appropriate to just allow a guy in there because he feels like a girl to, you know, change and shower with the ladies?
I can understand the concern of the parents. Mm-hmm. I could see why you wouldn't want your daughter maybe seeing what is physically a nude male, even if he believes he's a woman.
I think there would be concerns with everyone because of the way America is.
Bingo! There's your winning answer. I think there would be concerns because of the way America is. Now, this guy went to his bosses there at Merck, Media Research Center, whatever that is, probably gets a lot of money from the Koch brothers or something, and said, I got this great idea. I'm going to go to the most conservative campus in Virginia, George Mason, the most conservative public campus in America, or in Virginia, and I'm going to ask them if they're not just all icky, grossed out, ooh, over transgendered students being able to pick the gender-appropriate bathroom. Only it didn't work. We're 3 minutes and 20 seconds into the clip. And you know what was interesting? When he was asking the young woman if he could go in and shower in her locker room, she didn't say, no, you're disgusting, get away, icky poo. Because, remember, we have to use that voice because Dan Joseph, intrepid reporter, did so. I think there would be concerns because of the way America is. And the way America is that we are bigoted, homophobic, gender-phobic, hung-up, twisted, puritanical, weird. Yeah. And obviously, Dan Joseph is proving that there are problems because of the way America is. Not because there's something wrong with the transgendered people.
and how we, you know, put people in groups.
So what if that kid walked into the girls' bathroom and said, hey guys, I'm going to shower and change with you. What, would you be okay with that?
No,
you'd have a problem with that.
Yeah.
But you'd be okay.
I would even. It's up to her.
I should qualify that's difficult situations.
Uncomfortable situations.
And I think that if I had a child that was transgendered, I would be afraid that he or she would feel uncomfortable showering with
it could them. Open up things to bullying, too.
Absolutely.
Because kids are mean, you know? This is going to apply to, like, first graders, kindergartners. Do you think it's okay just to have
a
boy?
I've heard a lot of stories of where kids that age have felt that way, and the parents are allowing them to express themselves and be who they are. So I think that's a great thing.
Okay.
Like, I think that's beautiful.
So you're in favor of this.
I'm
you think this
favor.
Is the right step. Got
yeah.
it. What would you say if you were a parent of, like, a teenage girl and you knew that situation was going to be happening in your school?
I could imagine, because I have a younger sister.
Okay.
I can imagine my parents would take that a little strangely.
Notice how the students always, they're all putting it off on their parents. Their parents are the bigoted troglodytes. These are college students, and they're actually learning to think like real live human beings. You know, maybe, you know, my daddy's a coal miner, and he ain't known for his breadth of his vision, you know. Right. He probably not, yeah. I don't think if I had a baby brother who was transgendered, I don't reckon my daddy'd let him live long enough to go to school. Probably throw him in a sludge pond up there behind the house. Ain't nobody going in there looking for nobody, even if you know it's there. You know what I mean? It's a sludge pond. It's toxic waste.
Be a little upset.
Yeah, probably.
And all of a sudden, this guy, who, you know, is a girl on the inside, I guess, walks in, and, you know, wants to take a shower. You think that would be okay?
I don't know how to answer that question. I mean, I guess there would be a lot of concern from a lot of people. I guess it's just different people would have different views on it.
But isn't it interesting that she doesn't say she's concerned?
But you'd be totally fine with that.
I mean, I would be iffy at first, I guess, then it would be
pretty
different. Yeah. It'd be pretty weird.
I feel like a girl on the inside.
I feel like it's coming from a good place, but it could be taken advantage of by people who maybe don't have the best intentions.
Or maybe it could be turned into a problem by people who are still living in the 14th, 19th century BCE. Meanwhile, having viewed this waste of pixels, the National Center for Transgender Equality said this video is just a hateful embarrassment. The people at MRC know that there are real trans people. They know we're not talking about boys who want to pretend that they're girls or girls who want to pretend they're boys. They know we're talking about people who have a gender identity that want to safely use the restroom in a way that is least disruptive. Because, see, if you're out trans and you try to go to the boy, you know, that is a very unsafe place. And again, I go back to my original thesis that maybe, just maybe, by changing a generation beginning with the 5-year-olds, there will be a few less trans people dead every year. And that's, I'm down with that. I'm okay. Yeah, Waggy noting in the chat room. Emphasis on the embarrassment. What a maroon! Oh, yeah. It's been a bit of a bumpy ride here for this Morin Monday, what with all the buffering and the internet problems. Lottie in the chat room, don't get too excited about those students, Bob. They're still at a conservative university, and somewhere between the third and fourth year, some evangelical professor will ram a Bible up their ass, and they'll graduate as right-wing nuts. Maybe, or maybe not. And I only say that because, well, this. And again, I'm going to have to double down and work extra hard for this coming prayer meeting Wednesday. But I offer you, and I think this is a, I think this is a pretty valid critique. I offer you Hemant Mehta, who is host and editor of FriendlyAtheist.com and the author of the Young Atheist Survival Guide. Hemant Mehta showed up in one of those phony baloney debates, the kind that Dr. Bill was talking about in his program earlier, where the idea of argument is not to make a persuasive statement of facts, but rather to take two people with diametrically opposed viewpoints and let them try to embarrass each other or intimidate or threaten or bully each other. But anyway, this past Sunday morning on Chicken Noodle News, they found a woman by the name of Rachel Evans, who is an evangelical blogger, and they also invited Hemant Mehta on to discuss why it is that young people don't want anything to do, so many, many young people don't want anything to do with Christianity. And, yes, Marty, I share your sentiment. Talking about Dan Joseph back there, Marty notes, I hope Sacha Baron Cohen sues this guy for ripping off Borat and that character he created. Oh, you mean, not Borat, you're talking about Bruno. Bruno. That was a Bruno ripoff, wasn't it? Yes, as a matter of fact, it was. Marty also noting, glory, hallelujah, pass the ammo, praise the Lord. Oh, wait, that's for Wednesday. So in this discussion about why it is that young people want nothing to do with Christianity, evangelical blogger Rachel Evans said, I think there's this assumption among a lot of Christian leaders that, you know, if we bring in some hipper worship bands at a coffee shop in the fellowship hall and maybe a pastor who wears skinny jeans, young adults will come flocking back to the church. Clearly that's not happening. Well, let's go to the file.
For today's Faces of Faith, we are talking about how millennials are leaving the church in droves. And if you need proof, all you need to do is look online, because websites like Reddit, which is a favorite among millennials, has more than 2 million people subscribed to a page on atheism. But the Christianity page has less than a tenth of that, 67,000.
And then there is this survey from 2012. One in four young adults say that they are, quote, unaffiliated with any religion, though many claim a religion when they were younger. To talk more about this, we have brought along two millennials. Joining us on the phone is Rachel Evans, who is an evangelical blogger, that is, an author, and she is 32. And the reason she's on the phone is because the weather up, I guess, by Nashville is pretty bad. And also, we have Hemant Mehta. He is the editor of Friendly Atheist. I keep wanting to say the friendly, but it's friendlyatheist.com. He is an author. He's also 30. And they both wrote about this at CNN.com's Belief blog. And welcome to the both of you.
Thank you. Rachel, let's start with you. You guys have slightly different opinions, but Rachel, why do you think
Before we start with Rachel, can I ask a question? Why does a major cable news network have a faith show? Aren't they working TBN's corner? Is Chicken Noodle News really that desperate now? Just a question. But no, let's go back to Rachel by phone.
Millennials are turning away from the church.
Yeah, well, I think there's this assumption among a lot of Christian leaders that, you know, if we bring in some hipper worship bands and a coffee shop in the fellowship hall and maybe a pastor who wears skinny jeans, young adults will come flocking back to the church. But clearly, that's not working. According to the Barna Group, 59% of young adults ages 18 to 29 with a Christian background have actually dropped out of church. Now, not all of these young adults are flocking to atheism. In fact, most still identify as Christians, still identify as people of faith, but they're not going to church anymore. And so what I find interesting is that 41% of these millennials with a Christian background who have dropped out of church say they're not looking for a hipper version of Christianity. They're actually looking for a more traditional faith. So I think folks are leaving not because they're not getting lattes. I think they're leaving because they're not feeling like they're connecting with Jesus. And so I think they're looking for churches that care for the poor, that make social justice, like anti-trafficking initiatives, a priority.
All right, Rachel, let me just stop you for a minute because I want Hammett to join the conversation here. And Hammett, you wrote about atheism. What makes that attractive for younger people?
Well, like Rachel said, not all the millennials who are leaving church are necessarily flocking to atheism, but if you ask young people, if you ask millennials, what comes to mind when they think of Christianity, when they think of the church, they will tell you it's anti-gay, anti-doubt, anti-woman, anti-science, anti-sex education. We all know what the church is against, and we really don't care what the church is for when you have that much baggage. And so for a lot of young people, they want to get away from the church. And more importantly, though, we're, as atheists, we're kind of bringing them along. We like exposing the church for all the bad things it does. And we say, like, look, we have reason on our side. All the evidence, all reality points to our side away from God. And it seems like when you keep pushing that message and you have more atheists coming out of the closet and being willing to say they are atheists, all of a sudden you have more people flocking not just away from the church, like Rachel is saying, but I think toward a place where, okay, God isn't so much an issue in their lives anymore.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. Below us only, what, earth? Above us only sky. Forget exactly what the verse is, but John Lennon had it pretty much down. But that's a great line. We all know what the church is against, and we really don't care what the church is for when you have that much baggage. And of course, there's benefit to be had out of, you know, the simple business of questioning. Clearly, Dan Joseph went to George Mason University thinking that he was going to find a bunch of little Rush Limbaugh listeners who would screech and scream and recoil and jump up on chairs and howl like a mouse had just run by. Ooh, transgender! They didn't. And I think it was actually the Baptist Church, what, 5, 6, 7 years ago, with its own internal polling, that found out that as quickly as children get away from the Baptist Church and go to college or enter life or something, they want absolutely nothing to do with the church. Because when you find out that somebody has lied to you for your entire life, which is a relatively short span of time for young people, then realizing you've been lied to becomes rather significant. Because if you lie to me about something like religion and threaten me with tickets out of hell and into heaven, what else have you been lying about? Texas Betsy pointing out, among Jews, the lowest affiliation rates by far are among 22 to 30-year-olds, post-college, pre-needing kindergarten, Hebrew school. And I guess that sort of suggest that maybe, you know, some come wandering back, perhaps when they realize their mortality and they start worrying about what's going to happen when the first spade of dirt hits the coffin or whatever. Maybe, maybe not. Cassie just dropped us a note. From up in Princeton. She says, "Dear Bob, in high school, I had one friend who had girl parts and dressed and combed her hair like a boy, but was completely comfortable being she and using the girl's bathroom. At college, one of my friends is transgender. She has boy parts, but may have an operation to have that changed around at some point in the future. She uses the ladies' room, but I don't think she has asked anyone's permission. She just goes in when the rest of us do. She doesn't play sports, so she doesn't have to shower with anyone. Then Cassie says, I'd actually be uncomfortable with her being on a women's tennis team because she has a guy's strong arms and legs, but I'm not sure what the solution is. The reality is that the bathroom thing is just not a big deal. Right, and with, you know, with whether it be Dr. Freud or Dr. Spock, we understand that children, long about the time of potty training, go through a certain query or, you know, an internalized psychological process whereby they understand things like bodily waste and blah, 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 blah. And then they get over it. Except apparently for evangelical fundamentalists who, like, you know, I don't know, George W. Bush, was potty trained at gunpoint. Filthy baby, bad, bad baby. And apparently it has profound and deleterious effects. It reminds me of an old, you know, there's the rivalry between Alabama and Auburn is profound and deep and among the greatest, hugest college rivalries in the country. And there was an old joke about an Alabama fan and an Auburn fan in the men's room standing next to each other at the urinals. And the Auburn fan gets done, zips up, goes over, washes his hands, scrubs real hard with the soap, and the Alabama fan just zips up and walks on by. And, you know, Auburn has this terrible, terrible inferiority complex. And the Auburn fan looks at the Alabama fan, and they're each wearing their respective T-shirts, and says, you know, down at Auburn on the plains, they teach us to wash our hands after we go to the bathroom. The Alabama fan says, well, you know, up to the capstone at the University of Alabama, they teach us not to pee on our hands. It's kind of that. And watching the sort of psychological gyrations and listening to these ex post facto rationalizations of why we have to continue to use, what was it Dr. John called it, the agency theory versus a performance theory of gender, really does little more than expose the weirdness of the right wing. And every last one of their bizarre, twisted hang-ups. So, you know, that's the issue here. Are we going to let a bunch of hung-up weirdos determine the future and fate of this already deeply flawed and indeed perhaps dystopian culture? And speaking of hang-ups and weird people, via the folks over at Ring of Fire. And in and of itself, this has an element of what the Dateline necessarily is Louisiana, a parish, East Baton Rouge Parish Town Hall meeting this past Thursday. The town hall was being held by my neighbor in Washington, D.C., David Vitter. And of course, and it will come as no shock to our buddies in Louisiana, somebody was there to ask, and his name was Bill Morgan, asked Senator Vitter, why can't we repeal Obamacare? and then went blathering on about government spending and deficits, and you know the drill. And then came David Vitter's moment to answer. No, there's no audio of this. You're mercifully spared. I wish you were right that nobody wants Obamacare. That's not true. Wow, you, what? Could it be? No, this is David Vitter. In fact, the other side, who absolutely wants it, most of whom are getting something for nothing, came out in droves in the last election, and our side sat home. Who are getting something for nothing. Because you see, isn't that neat? When you go to the insurance exchanges, all the insurance is free. Only it's not. This is the same thing as the idiots that I referenced at the beginning of the program. The idiots a couple of years ago clapping at the idea of letting somebody lay dying in a hallway somewhere for want of health care, and all the little teabaggers just clapped. Oh, clap your hands. Or the vicious assholes in Tennessee who clapped and cheered and yelled when Congressman Scott Desjarlais explained to that uppity little 11-year-old brown-skinned girl that we got some laws here and we're going to follow them and we're going to get rid of your daddy. So, in point of fact, we only have the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act because the people who want it are just a bunch of freeloaders who want something for nothing. How much of America is driven by the working poor, by the people who work two jobs, maybe one at Wendy's and another at, who knows? And yet cannot have health care. Does Senator Vitter really just not give a damn if they live or die? It's probably a self-answering question, isn't it? They ain't running no oil rigs. Hell with them. Because that really is about the size of it. And I love how people came out in droves to support Obamacare. Only problem is, if they came out in droves to support it, why is David Vitter still in office, assuming he ran last election? Why is the House of Representatives caught in the tender mercies of a majority that doesn't even believe in the fundamental concepts around which government in this country was formed? Oh, they come out in droves. I mean, you can almost, with your little old mind's eye, you can almost see. You can almost see the zombie hordes, can't you? Droves, I tell you. Droves. More in Monday. And I offer this nomination for More in Monday up with pre-admitted bias. I have stated before, and in case you were wondering, I am still a nicotine addict. I would like not to be a nicotine addict. But, so, last month, an article was published in the journal Plus One, PLOSONE, unless that's a typo. And the journal article was all about why it is that smokers find it so gall-danged hard to quit smoking, some of them to the point that they cannot. And of all the things that have been said and done and written about nicotine addiction, I mean, remember, we have places where Rush Limbaugh can go and pet horses until he's no longer jonesing for the oxy. We have places to go and dry out if you've got a coke problem. We have a place to go and get recovery going if you've got a drinking problem. On the other hand, about the only thing you can do if you've got a nicotine problem is to put them down and gut it out. And maybe, just, oh, maybe, a local hospital has a support group that meets maybe once a week or so. So you can sit around and talk about how badly you'd like to have an effing cigarette. Well, it turns out, according to this journal, the New York Times printed an op-ed by the journal study authors I.L. Ert and Eldad Yechaim, in which they ask, given how hazardous it is to their health, why do smokers continue to smoke? It's not that they're all hopeless addicts. Many smokers are capable of quitting. I'm guessing Eyal Ert and Eldad Yechaim aren't smokers, not cigarette smokers. I'm not talking about the most interesting man in the world with a fine Cuban Corona and a bottle of Dos Equis in one hand and a bottle of Dos Equis in the other. It's not that they are ignorant, they write. Studies show that smokers are at least as informed as non-smokers about the risks of smoking, and possibly more informed. You might suspect, then, that smokers tend to be risk-takers by nature, and some evidence suggests that smokers do take more risks than non-smokers. They're more often involved in traffic accidents, less likely to wear seatbelts, and more likely to engage in risky sexual behavior. Women who smoke even have mammograms less frequently than their non-smoking counterparts. You know, when you start reading something like that, and that's the front end of the article, you get a pretty good idea that it's going to be a rough ride. And yet, here are these two scientists, I.L. Ert and Eldad Yechaim, who say, we don't believe that smokers have a greater tolerance for risk. In the middle of an op-ed in the New York Times that's going to introduce us to their study, they use the word believe. Should the word believe even appear in some... No. As we argue in a study published this month in the journal PLOS One, it is PLOS One, the personality trait that distinguishes smokers from non-smokers is their relative inability to delay satisfaction and respect long-term considerations like their health. In other words, it's their poor self-control. Really? A pair of presumably, reasonably well-educated scientists just said that smokers can't quit because they have poor self-control. I'm looking for the paragraph down here that says that smokers masturbate in public, too, because, well, poor self-control. Oh, for heaven's sakes. And they came to this conclusion by having test subjects perform something called the Iowa gambling task. One offers payoffs that commonly result in immediate satisfaction. It produces a gain of $100 in 9 out of 10 draws, but in 1 of 10 draws it produces a disaster, losing $1,250. The other bad deck is less immediately satisfying. The losses are smaller, $250, but more frequent, occurring about every second draw. Thus, both decks are bad overall, but the first is more satisfying in the short run. And there's two other decks. And so, in other words, we're going to find out that why smokers can't quit smoking by analyzing how good they are at playing cards. Well, hell. They say it is not risk-taking per se that drives smokers' risky behavior. It is a weakness for activities that are profitable most of the time, yet hazardous eventually. I would like to introduce these jokers to me. I would particularly like to introduce these jokers to me on about a 12-hour... I tell you what, no. Let's introduce these jokers to me on a flight from, I don't know, New York to Johannesburg, or maybe L.A. to Sydney. And they can even bring their little goddamn gambling decks with them. And we will play cards until I've got my hands around their throats. Not because I don't like them. Not because they're obviously woefully ignorant about the nature of addiction. Well, yeah, kind of because they're woefully ignorant of the nature of addiction. They've never been addicted to anything. This is not me saying poor, poor, pitiful me. This is me saying if we're serious about breaking these addictions, then let's get some Betty Ford centers out there for the me's of the world, where we can take 6 weeks with me in a pair of gym shorts, staring at my navel, maybe doing needlecraft or talking to horses or something. Because, see, I'm not going to take a drug like Chantix that says, Chantix can help you quit smoking, but it may make you want to blow your effing brains out somewhere along the way. Because I've quit enough times that's part of the process anyway, and I don't need it. I don't need an amplifier for it. You know me. There's not a conservative right-wing bone in my body. This kind of stuff makes me crazy, though. We asked 100 people to play cards, and therefore, nicotine addicts have poor self-control. Whew. That's world class. Does that explain the success or failure of the so-called e-cigarettes? I kind of doubt it. I'm just checking by... Oh, darn it. Checking the chat room to see if there's a bunch of pushback on this. But any time that you come up with a single... With a magic bullet theory... It just somehow seems... unlikely that you're going to come up with a real answer, because addiction is real. If I could find it on this old computer, it's an old computer that's got a... Never mind. There's a bit from way back in the very beginnings of The Horn, one of my many attempts to quit smoking. And I kid you not, I mean, I put on the patch, drank a lot of water, and took a lot of deep breaths, and peeled all my fingernails, and took a lot of walks in the yard, and it was a weekend. Every now and then I'd kind of look over at my left arm where the nicotine patch was, and I'd kind of smack it and give it a little rub, get a little more junk going into the system. And I finally said, okay, screw this. I'm going to call the smoking cessation hotline. And it was a Saturday. Maybe it was a Sunday. And when I called the smoking cessation hotline, some of you may remember this if you've been around sharing the conversation that long. Some of you may recall that I got a recording telling me that the Smoking Cessation Hotline was open from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time, Monday through Friday. And then it put me on hold. And the music that I was played while on hold, no kidding, was the Muzak version of Please Don't Talk About Me When I'm Gone. Really? That's some funny guy. So we've got a definite More in Monday nomination for Messieurs, what were their names? Urkel and Yechaim? Yeah. Thanks for the sour persimmons, brother. Next time you get the urge to help, don't. If you know what I mean. So, let's go to the phones. You know the number. It is Conversation Radio, after all. It's 3 minutes past 8. 304-658-3333. And we'll see what's going on here. Hey, welcome to the program.
This is Edward.
Hey, Edward. How are you?
I'm fine. And I've enjoyed your talk about tobacco. I grew up in North Carolina, right in the middle of the big tobacco-growing country. And I didn't start smoking until I was 20. And I quit when I was about 65. Anyway, there are myths about quitting smoking. For quite a while, I quit smoking, except I smoked everybody else's cigarettes.
Right.
You know how that is.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. I did that. And then I finally quit. And I was at a party, and someone offered me a cigarette. And my partner said, oh, if you take one puff, you'll just be addicted forever again. So I said, well, I'm going to try it. So I did, and I smoked the cigarette. You know, it didn't bother me at all. I came home, didn't even think about it. And I've done that several times since then. Maybe I'm just weird. Well, I know that.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so in the least, Edward. You beat the addiction, and you know that's the thing that these two Jaspers don't understand. There's the chemical addiction, the psychological addiction, the physical addiction. I mean, it's just this great big nasty little wad of addictions that has to be overcome.
I know, and see, I think back to my daddy when he'd come back. He was a chief water officer in the U.S. Coast Guard. And he'd come home, and he'd been down in the Caribbean and everything, and he used a bay rum as a shaving lotion, and he smoked Lucky Strikes. And I've always remembered my daddy picking me up, and I thought he smelled so good. Cigarettes and bay rum.
Well, by Jove, you know, I'll bet that wasn't an obnoxious aroma.
No, it wasn't. It was good, let me tell you. Anyhow, I'll let you go, but I just want to let you know there are others out there that suffered through the slings and arrows of outrageous
Edward, I mean, honest to Pete, how long, because, see, I remember my dad passed away at 82,
mm-hmm.
And he had managed, for some reason or another, we made him quit smoking, and I feel awful about it to this day.
Mm-hmm.
Made him quit smoking shortly before he died.
Well,
and right before he died, he looked at me and he said, son, and I said, what? He said, I'd like to have a cigarette about 3 feet long.
I understand exactly what he meant. Absolutely. Well,
but I just, you know, I have
trying,
no...
I was trying to do the best thing for him, but, I mean, at that age, of course, I don't smoke now unless I go to a party and... If I have a martini, I got to have a cigarette.
Yeah, it's kind of like Mad Men, isn't it?
Yeah.
There are certain, Chablis, Brie, martini, smoke.
Yeah,
I get it. Yeah, or maybe a scotch or a nice rum and a good Cuban cigar. Well, hello. Yeah. Edward, you have yourself a good evening.
You do the same.
All right. Bye now.
And I hope I didn't bother you about talking about smoking anymore.
Oh, no, no, not at all. Not at all. I'm a junkie, and I admit it. You have a good night, Edward.
Thank you.
Bye now. And moving onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
You mean this is live?
It ain't Memorex. I don't think they make Memorex anymore, do they?
I don't think so. Boy, I remember they used to. God, that's my old man. When I was a kid, my dad and my uncle were into tape recording, and they got me into it. And my first tape recorder was a monaural thing that cost around $100 in 1959.
Reel to reel.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I loved it. You attach two wires to your TV speakers and a line back to your... And my dad, when he passed away, I got unloaded a huge box of Timex jazz specials, and I wish I had listened to them more, because tape, you know what happens to tape when it gets old?
It's about
as cranky as I am now, you know.
Yeah, it stops responding very well to any sort of...
Well, yeah, responding, hell, I mean, 22-year-old could walk in here and I'd probably stop... I'd try, but I'd probably stop responding, you know?
Yeah.
That's part of that gizmo. I've been looking for a book, and I thought I'd toss a name out there, and maybe somebody can email something to you about where the hell you find bookstores where you can actually talk to people and to sell history stuff or used stuff, you know? I am so sick of this online stuff where they throw a price at you, you know?
Yeah.
And they don't throw a phone number so you can call them and talk to them and see if you're really going to get what they're looking for or what you're looking for. I'm looking for an off-the-wall book called The Gardeners of Salonica, which was written by a guy named Alan Palmer. And it covers this... I don't know how familiar you are with a thing called the Allied Army of the Orient that landed in Greece. Salonika, that's where, I think, wasn't that Thessalonica?
Well, Thessaloniki.
At one time when Paul was spreading the gospel?
Thessalonians was his first book.
Yeah, and it was interesting because the French and English fleets went over to the coast of Serbia and picked off every... These Serbians came marching in the winter over the mountains to the seacoast, and they led the charge into Serbia out of Greece in 1918, and the Bulgarians quit, and the Austrians quit, and the French sent out a raiding cavalry force of North African riders, you know, the guys we used to see chasing Buster Crabbe around television.
Right.
And, man, they raised hell. And that was around the time that Ludendorff put an entry in his book on August 8th of 18, a black day for the German army, because the English had launched an attack on the Western Front that was backed up by a few hundred small tanks, kind of a history-making event.
Yeah.
And that was August 8th, and the Germans were done. You know, what did they do? Surrender? What was it? Armistice, November 11th?
1918.
Yeah, so if anybody has any names of bookstores that are, I mean, Bob, is it me, this idea of trying to buy something without talking to somebody on the other end of the line? Is it my age that, or am I just, stupid or stubborn or what?
There is still a lot of pleasure to be had in the so-called brick and mortar experience.
Yes. Well, the idea, I mean,
but the online business model is slowly choking it to death.
Yeah, yeah. I have a lot of people out there who I think know something about history bookstores and might be able to throw some numbers you could pass along to me.
Tell me the name of the book again.
The Gardeners of Salonica, which is written by Alan Palmer, and hell, I read it so many years ago, but I sent it to the Site Center, and they have volunteers. they have volunteers that'll record this stuff for you.
Yeah.
And that is a godsend to me. I have a collection of stuff that I sent up there that you can't get on audio, you know. And that's my only way of keeping in touch with what I used to know. Because I don't know how they're bringing out new stuff. Now, the Library of Congress does have good stuff. And they send you a thing every month of the new stuff they got. They just had a new thing a couple months ago that was another history of D&B and Foo. And boy, do I recommend books, a book like that one to anybody who doesn't realize how deep the Dulles brothers were into getting us involved in the French Indochina War in 1954. They were trying to get us into that, Bob.
Sure. And it's interesting that you mention that because it came as a surprise to, I think, exactly no one. But for some reason or another, today, or in the last couple of days, the CIA redacted enough documentation to formally admit for the first time that it was behind the 1953 coup against Mohammad Mossadegh.
Yeah. We've thought that way for years. And I was a little worried. You know, when I first heard people talking in the 60s, well, I wondered how many of these guys were just so... Were they really anti the country they lived in, or were they anti the actions? Because now, I turned 18 in 1961. So I was kind of... I took part in a lot of anti-war demonstrations, and... But I would argue with the people, because it wasn't that I was a complete pacifist, Bob. I still felt that if somebody had smacked Adolf Hitler in the face earlier, we might have been better off. But sometimes I wonder if the Western nations didn't do it because there was money to be made. Who was the Bush family member who was...
Prescott.
Yeah, wasn't Prescott fined heavily for dealing with the Nazis?
Yep, 1943 Trading with the Enemy Act.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, the fathers of the Koch brothers, their father, wasn't he involved with Stalin?
Yes, he was. He went over there and set up oil drilling operations, and it was he said it was because of the brutality of the communist regime, which he witnessed, that he came back a rabid anti-communist and, of course, became the money behind, what was his name, Robert Welch?
Yeah.
And the John Birch Society. But in point of fact, I think it boiled down to Stalin stiffed him.
Yeah. Well, that wouldn't surprise me that that's what set him off. Because would I be surprised if Stalin stiffed him? No. Probably.
But he wasn't a rabid anti-communist when he went over there to do the work.
Mm-hmm. He was over there helping the guy out.
Wow, if only Stalin had been a capitalist, what a different world. You consider what the Koch brothers would be today.
What I try to tell young people is, when they discover something, this crap went on years ago. One of my heartfelt stories is my mother telling me how my grandmother, who had left Breslau, Germany in 1900 or so, they kept all that concentration camp stuff quiet here. As they did the Bataan Death March, there was an American flyer who got back here, and he started talking. And all of a sudden, the government had to say, well, yeah, there was this death march, and blah, 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 and what were they keeping it quiet for? You're already at war with the SOB, so, you know. And I'm pretty sure that the... And what a lot of people don't realize that the final solution for people of Jewish extraction was... The huge, huge part of the iceberg, but it was a big iceberg. The gypsies, you fill in the blank with people that Uncle Adolf was getting rid of, you know. And that's the thing about history. People think when something happens, it's brand new. And I think you and I and a lot of other people can sit here. You can go back a lot farther than I can. You guys leave me in the dust when you get back to Rome. I read a little bit about Hannibal and that, and Dr. Bill, man, he has just worked me over good because I, you know.
Did you catch him today, Bill?
just a little bit today. Yeah.
His discussion of Lochner and the and the dissents in Lochner, Holmes and what was his name, Harlan, was nothing more than just eye popping.
Wasn't that late 19th century, early 20th?
Yeah, it's the early 20th century, and it has to do with the state of New York trying to put limits on the hours that bakers could work.
Yeah, that was Gilded. Lochner was a Gilded Age SOB, wasn't he?
Yeah, and what's more, Lochner is the fondest dream and most yearned-for desire of the so-called modern conservative movement.
Yeah, that modern,
If you catch them talking quietly together about three martinis in, they'll sit there and talk to you, and you can hear them talking about how we need a return to Lochner. I mean, they say crap like that. I'm not kidding. It's like you know, going down to Alabamistan and catching a few of the good old boys all liquored up until they get to start talking about, well, you know, the Klan, I thought the Klan served a purpose. It's that same unreconstructed nonsense.
Yeah, I sent that thing, a buddy down in south of me here sent me the something I could read on that George Thomas piece. And I shipped it to a buddy of mine on the West Coast, and he wrote back, bullshit. Because he's a Lee supporter, you know. And he's a guy who was raised up north here, but he's got an attitude. And although we're good friends about most everything else, we sure don't agree on that. Bob, a traitor is a traitor, whether it's if the Rosenbergs were indeed traitors and gave nuclear secrets to the Soviets, I can understand why the country wasn't happy with them.
Yeah.
But how many other blanks do we want to fill in there? Like Bush's, the first President Bush's father and the second one's grandfather. We shouldn't be real happy with people like that, too.
No.
Yeah, and they're full blooded, man. You don't get, they're full blooded capitalists, no doubt about it. Take the money and run crowd.
Well, except for the fact that they've never worked an honest day in their lives. Remember yeah. the Bush bunch, I think, first got their front feet in the trough with the First World War, when one of them was named a member of the War Materiels Board.
Oh, yeah, because we, the United States, neutral as they supposedly were, American companies. In fact, I just read this thing on Castles of Steel about the German and English the two imperial navies, you know. And one thing, there was an American businessman whose name was familiar, and I can't remember it, but it's familiar to me today from somebody who's big in the stock market. It was the stock market name. And this guy went over to England, and he got contracts that he brought back here. And they were building submarines for England. I guess up at what they used to call Electric Boat, was that up?
Yeah, what was that, Groton?
Groton, Connecticut, yeah. Because when that war started, I'll give you a rundown on submarines. Who had the most? England. Next, France. Next, Russia. Next, the U.S. And dragging up the rear of the big nations, believe it or not, was Germany.
Right.
Because Kaiser Wilhelm, he liked those big impressive ships, you know. He was trying to catch the English Navy. And I had heard that stuff a long time ago, and that's partly what led to that whole mess. You know, the Kaiser, the Tsar, and the King of England, I believe, were all cousins.
Yeah, it was all in the family.
Yeah, Victoria.
Well, if you read Barbara Tuchman's The Guns of August.
August, yes. I haven't
it begins with the death of who was the royal, Edward?
Yeah.
In what, 1910, 1911, 1912,
yeah,
1913,
right
somewhere
there,
like
yeah.
When all the crowned heads of Europe showed up for the funeral, and it was the last time that they spoke civilly to one another, and they were all kinfolks.
Oh, yeah. It's that whole, see, I have a problem with the...
Why is it we make incest jokes about hillbillies, but not European monarchs?
Yeah, European royalties. They were right up in doing their part, weren't they? Well, the only joke I remember was calling people in the middle of drugstores and asking if they had Prince Albert in the can. You know that. Let him out before he suffocates was the ha-ha when you're 12 years old. That's funny as hell, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, I'll let you go, but if anybody has any ideas where they can...
Well, I've seen two already. Mark has sent me a link to the book at Amazon, and it's also been linked in the chat room at Powell's Books. But of course, you need some sort of audio version, right?
Yeah, yeah. And that's if I get it in book form, which one friend of mine might have located it in a library, I can take it to the Society for the Blind, and they actually have volunteers. I have some things in my collection.
I used to do that once upon a time. No kidding.
Oh yeah, you read them?
Yeah.
Good.
I was it wasn't specifically for the visually impaired, but that was my work study job when I was in college.
Well, you were working for a company, huh?
No, I was working for the college. I read textbooks onto tape for people with various learning disabilities, whether it be visual impairment or dyslexia or what have you.
Well, I wish they would have had something for me. My personal story was they pulled me out of my house when I was in the third grade and put me in a Catholic children's home, not because of anything I did, but because of problems my mother was having. And, Bob, I hit that place, and I became a damn good baseball and football player, but, man, my grades took a crap that was unbelievable.
Well, I do have to tell you, I heard from a little bird that you play Happy Birthday on the harp really, really well.
Well, I was just kidding around with that guy. He knows who it is. I just happened to see one sitting in front of me, and I forget. I think it was a key of F just laying there on the desk. And I said, what the hell? He's a good guy. You know, the people I've had personal contact with, you talk about the Horn family, you got the right word. And you talk about Texas Betsy a lot, and I start smiling because my first wife was Jewish, and her dad and I would sit down and go back and forth on religious stuff, and he was never hostile or anything. Well, hell, when your daughter brings home a German Catholic for a husband, I mean, what the hell are you going to do, you know? Great family, one of the best. Her brother went to Diesel Tech School and one of the best dentists mechanics. Her other brother's a dentist, and she's a... I just had a two-hour conversation. My first wife and I put up with each other when we were really young idiots, you know?
Yeah.
Nothing like a couple of hippies getting married in the 1960s. But so I get it. I mean, you talk about Texas Betsy, and it makes me smile to remember my father-in-law and I used to say, well, the people sinned, and that's why the Romans overran Israel, or the Greeks overran Israel, or the, you know, whatever conquering group.
And you know what? I bet you could find it on some sort of audio version. I did. I said on the program a couple of weeks ago that after the whole moment of profound stupidity with Radio Rwanda interviewing Reza Aslan over his new book Zealot,
yeah,
and the revolutionary teachings of the historical Jesus, I said, well, I'm gonna have to break down and read it. Well, I'm reading it. That's one of the nice little perks of this business, is that every now and then you can, if you're willing to spend a little bit of time, you don't have to spend any dough, and you can get a review copy. So I'm probably gonna have the guy on, but I would... If you're interested, I can say this much, if you're interested at all in that time period, this guy does a brilliant job laying out what the culture was like, what the climate was like, and I'm not talking about whether it was hot or cold, you know, what the political climate was like, and how, you know, how the rise of the nascent Christianity fits into all of that. And it's absolutely brilliant. The guy really is a scholar.
Well, what I used to tell my old Mr. Cass, my first father-in-law, I used to say, Esai is Sheldon. I used to say, you know, look, where is Israel located? And we pointed a map and said, look where they're located. If you're a Greek conqueror or a Roman conqueror or Egyptian, anybody trying to get from North Africa to the Middle East and vice versa, who did they have to walk over to get there? Whose nation did they have to walk over? And if you displayed any kind of independence feeling, regardless of religion, independent humanity was enough to get you problems with the conqueror. If you're in the wrong place, one of my best friends that I made in the last 3 years is a kid from the Ukraine. And he really gave me the history of the famine that Stalin instituted in the 30s. You know, where he starved the Ukrainian people. I mean, it's the old story about being in the wrong place at the right wrong time. And and as I say, I have nothing against the Southern soldier. I thought they were some of the bravest men I ever saw, you know, or read about. I never did see any of them. Well, maybe if I had another couple of drinks, I might. but seriously, you and I agree on one thing, that maybe some of this leadership, I mean, if these guys popped up on the left wing today, if Davis and Lee and the rest of them were all leftists, can you imagine what the conservatives would be screaming about?
Hang them high.
Exactly. That would be their answer to it, and I definitely think that, and I don't know how you feel about the Lincoln's assassination. Did we really get the truth, or is that something that somebody decided to tell us? Who the hell knows?
I think we're pretty close to it.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot, mostly truth. I think,
because among other things, we know so much about the aftermath.
Yeah.
For instance, and you know, these are some. If you bother with history at all, Bill, you find out that this country has a lot more really profoundly dark and despairing moments than any of us would probably like to admit.
Well, I don't know.
But for instance, a Supreme Court justice actually issued a writ of prohibition stopping the execution of Mary Surratt.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
And the military went ahead under the, and we've, you know, we can think back to other times in history that the same question has been asked. The writ of prohibition was served on, who was it, Stanton?
Yeah.
Telling him not to execute Mary Surratt. And he asked something similar along the lines of, and how many divisions does the justice command?
Yeah. The old Pope versus Stalin line that I heard years ago, yeah.
And went ahead and hanged her. And, of course, there was no evidence whatsoever. I mean, she was pro-Southern, absolutely.
Yeah.
She was anti-Lincoln, certainly.
How many million were like that?
Right. And yes, she was, because of the war, among other things, she was running a boarding house in what is now Chinatown in Washington, D.C., and, yeah, the people that stayed with her tended to be seditious and agitators and whatnot. But there was never a shred of evidence that she had anything whatsoever to do with the conspiracy.
Yeah.
And in point of fact, John Wilkes Booth did not stay in that boarding house. And in point of fact, the conspiracy that was hatched there, and there really was a conspiracy hatched in her boarding house among people like Louis Paine. And others. But the conspiracy that they hatched was to kidnap Abraham Lincoln and to hold him for ransom for a negotiated settlement of the war.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the war came to an end rather too quickly to suit them, and at that point in time, Paine and John Wilkes Booth modified the plan to the point that it wasn't the plan anymore and changed it to a massive, massive assassination campaign, because Paine was supposed to kill Seward.
Seward, yeah.
Booth was supposed to kill Lincoln. Somebody was supposed to go after Stanton, and somebody else was supposed to kill Andrew Johnson.
Well, I know Grant was supposed to be hit, but he and his wife left town and went to Philadelphia, I think, at that point.
And if I'm not mistaken, that had to do with the fact that Mrs. Grant could not stand Mrs. Lincoln.
Yeah,
because Grant was actually scheduled to attend the performance of Our American Cousin at Ford's Theater, and Mrs. Grant said, "No, Hiram, no, we're not gonna."
Hiram, yeah.
Well, that was his name.
Yes, sir. Hug. It said on his baggage when he came home from West Point, he had a bag with HUG written on it.
Hiram Ulysses Grant.
Grant. Yep.
Ulysses Simpson Grant was entirely a creation of the media because it made a nice little abbreviation for unconditional surrender.
Well, wasn't part of her name Simpson?
I don't know.
I don't know anymore either. It's been a while, but it just Yeah, it's amazing how long ago that was, but how the publicity and the newspapers were already starting to shake out their, where they are today, or what's left of them. It bothers me to see the newspapers fold. That's mainly because I don't think enough people can read anymore. But
the newspapers are folding because they gave the profiteers their heads and forgot that the central purpose of a newspaper is not advertising, but the generation of information, news. Yeah. And so you've got operations like Gannett that are slashing their newspaper staffs, like Dr. John pointed out, even though they are their profit has been on the rise.
I had a couple good friends, one who wrote for the Cleveland Press, and man, he won a Pulitzer for his. He did an expose on the sale of the press to the Plain Dealer, and he wrote a thing that Peter Phipps, his name was, and he won a Pulitzer for that. He won a prize in Ohio for sure. I thought it was a Pulitzer, though, because he exposed the.
Now, see, that's no fair, Bill, because you can't mention Ohio journalism prizes without making me immediately think of Les Nessman and his Silver Sow and his Copper Cob.
Yeah, well, that was a great television show.
That's the Silver Sow, Johnny, right? You are, Les.
You talk about laughter. God, I mean, well, that's the other thing. There was, I'm not going to say much about, because I don't know, you've got youngsters, and I can't understand the zombie stuff. When I was a kid, Abbott and Costello Meet the Zombies, that's, you know.
And the Mummy, and yeah. Dracula, and, right.
Hey, they want to be horrified. They ought to see some of my ex-landlords and bosses, and that'll horrify you. Honest to God, I just don't get, unless these kids see it deeper. And when they look at the zombies, they look at a lot of people they know.
No, but see, from a historical perspective, Bill, you can understand the zombies as a manifestation similar to when, let's put it this way, representative art, visual art, changed dramatically from before the arrival of the Black Death in Europe to after the Black Death in Europe. After the Black Death in Europe, all of a sudden you see these apocalyptic representations of death and skeletons and horrible, horrible imagery. And I think zombies, on the one hand, they're kind of fun in their video game form.
Yeah.
And cathartic. But on the other hand, it's a manifestation of theirs, and they're latent and innate. I think there's something at a gut level that we recognize down deep inside that the entirety of world culture is teetering on a very, very fragile precipice, and we're one sort of dribbling away and dropping into the canyon dirt clod from being Wile E. Coyote.
Yeah, don't sneeze. Yeah. Well, I'm fascinated. I mean, I'm familiar with. A lot of the voodoo, a lot of people took the fastest ship out of Haiti when the Haitian revolt, and of course, where did they go?
Yeah,
where there was French speaking people. And I'll leave you with one quick thing. You and I talk about the coffee with the chicory.
Yeah,
I buy mine at a Vietnamese store, and you know why the Vietnamese drink it that way?
No.
Well, the French went over there in about 1870. In fact, the delicatessen where I buy Café Du Monde is the brand I'm using now, as opposed to French Market and a few other brands.
Louisiane does a brand that's respectable,
yeah,
too.
Louisiane used to make a chili mix that was out of this world, too, for a guy who couldn't really cook the stuff that well. I go into the Vietnamese store, and there's that Café Du Monde sitting there. And I said, yeah, because what happens when cultures... Just like good old Tsingtao beer, you know, Germans go take up space and buy it, lease it from some other country, and what's the first thing they have to do besides build naval stuff? A brewery. German is it that doesn't have good beer with them. Anyway, I'll let you go, but if you can email me any of this stuff, but you're right about it, that's my problem with that that big company that runs the internet that can sell you anything. But the problem is, I can't really do business with them over the internet. I need some guys you can call and order the damn thing, give them a credit card number, and do things that way. I hate putting credit card numbers on the internet. I'm too.
Well, you might have better luck looking for it at Powell's then, because I think you can still call Powell's Books.
Powell's, where are they located?
They're down in Texas, I think.
Okay, because I have to have a city to get information to give me a number. I need city and state. Unless somebody sends you that Powell's.
Well, yeah, hang on. Okay, everybody. Somebody find me a telephone ordering number for Powell's Books.
Yeah.
And shoot it to me, bobkincaid@gmail.com.
See, I may luck out on this, and a friend of mine may be able to get it from the Cleveland Public Library, because that's where I first read the book so many years ago. I think it was around the time it came out and hit the market in the 60s. Because that is the most fascinating little section of World War II you hear nothing, World War I you hear nothing about. But here it is, these guys sat there for so long and did nothing. And that's where the nickname Gardeners came from. The Germans hung it on them. They said all these guys did was dig in and sit there. And they, but when they opened up in 1918, they just cleared everybody out of their way. And when Austria quit, the back door to Germany was wide open. And that was in, you know, August or September. And the Germans by September of 18, they were done.
Well, Isaac has kindly provided a phone number.
Okay.
It is for Powell's Books, 800.
Okay.
878.
Okay.
7323.
Would you do that again, please?
800 878 7323.
Okay, I'll give him a shot. And you can tell Mr. Superman, my buddy down there, is a guy I've never. Man, does he know what he knows. I'm telling you, he's on the money with what he knows and what he does. And the people he works with are, I think you probably know some of the people he works with in the music world. And
yeah, know of, highly yeah. respect.
Yeah, really.
And for the next time through, Isaac also pointed out, this is not a Santa story, but Bill has a great shaving cream story he can tell on the air.
I'm not going to go into depth. Bob, one of these days, if we're ever, I should send you an email, but it's, Isaac is my type of man, no doubt about it. We have a lot of behavior in our lives in common when it comes to, like I tell younger people, when that sexual merry-go-round and it started to revolve and you're playing in a band, I can't tell you how insane it was. Although you probably caught a good ride yourself as a college kid in those days. Things were just, all those things that I was taught when I was a youngster in high school and junior high, it's like, what happened here?
Out the window.
Yep. Anyway, hang in there.
All right, you too. Take care, Bill. Bye now. Our buddy Bill, Mr. Stress, calling from Cleveland. Bill doesn't know how to have a bad conversation. Thank you, Isaac. Now I've got the background. Well, here we are, 17 minutes to go in the program, and it's probably my fault because of all the technical difficulties that have bedeviled us through the course of the evening. But Texas Betsy kindly put a $100 challenge on the table this evening, and it has gone unresponded to. And, well, like I said, we were already in a hole. And it's going to get deeper. And I'm sorry. I try not to sit here and just, you know, worry. And I'm certainly not trying to impose any guilt. And, you know, I guess if somebody called tomorrow and said, hey, Bob, we want to run some Buy Gold Now ads, and we're willing to pay enough to keep you on the air for a year. Yeah, I guess we'd be running Buy Gold Now ads, and I'd just be a hypocrite. And we'd go back to the punchline to that old joke that says, we know what you are. Now we're just haggling about price. Yeah. But no, we have not a single penny raised this evening. I have a story. I've got two stories here. Oh, okay. Texas Betsy noting that I am a Jewish mother, and I am more than happy to foster guilt. No. Kate is not the horn. She's not a Jewish mother, too. Kate just knows how to. Well, when Kate says that she has this icky fear that someday she'll tune in the stream and it'll just be Glockenspiel music forevermore. She ain't kidding. She's not kidding. So, yeah, here we go. I got a couple of stories here, and we have our fun on. Yeah, Isaac. Isaac says, Mr. Stress is my hero. Yeah, I'm with you there. I'm with you there, Isaac. Thank you, Sal. Thank you very much. Sal is so often first past the post with fundraising, and thank you very much, Sal. It is deeply appreciated. Robert wrote in, and this is just one of the it's one of the nice little things about the little family commune we've created here. I'm excited because I'll probably get to see people I haven't seen in a long time when I go to Wisconsin, and I'll get to meet people that I deeply respect and have never met before when I go to Texas. It's beautiful. It is absolutely beautiful. And you guys meet each other. Maybe someday I'll get to meet Bill, like some of y'all have. But the greater the distance, the less the likelihood of ever meeting. And that certainly applies to our good friend and longtime stalwart, Robert in Australia, on my nicotine remarks. Robert wrote in a little bit ago and said, how my dad, a smoker since his teens, gave up smoking. His doctor said to him, if you want to be alive in 2 years, you'll stop smoking today. My father did, probably the hardest thing he ever had to do. I'm sure he still gets cravings. A lot of damage had already been done, and he's had 4 heart bypass operations since stopping. 30 years later, though, he's still with us, and the only thing that annoys him now is that he's had to stop playing golf. And that would be annoying. For diehard golfers, even the ones who aren't very good, like me, not playing is deeply annoying. I haven't played in, Jesus, I can't count the years. Probably 10, 9, 8, something like that. But I do. When I see stories that come out of various areas, I think about the people who live in those areas and who might have some sort of relevance to offer on a story. Or in the case of this one, which is just absolutely horrifying. Sorry, we're going to end More In Monday on a horrifying note. And the Moran nomination is certainly for the people in Oklahoma, Stan, and not for the young man himself. And I guess Dave Zirin had a brilliant column a couple of weeks ago when the whole performance-enhancing drug thing hit about baseball, you know, again. And he, in his own inimitable style, he pointed out that baseball was being just a wee tiny bit, no great big hypocritical over performance-enhancing drugs because you can buy them over the counter in the Dominican Republic, which is one great big farm system, a great big oppressive farm system for Major League Baseball, where young people start taking these performance-enhancing drugs at tender ages in order to hopefully get away from the sandlots and make it if not to the big leagues, then, you know, maybe Triple A, because compared to the living you can make in the Dominican Republic, Triple A is pretty damn good. Pretty damn good. And so you understand, if you're in Haiti or the Dominican Republic, or if you're in Somalia, or if you're in Guatemala or Honduras or Mexico, why you would at least foster the idea of coming to the United States, that there was some greater opportunity here, if not for yourself, then for your progeny. But if you live in civilization, if you live in Australia, if you live in Germany or Japan or France or the UK, why the F would you ever, ever, ever come here? I don't know. And that was the first question that struck me. Why would you come here? When I read this story, an Australian family was Monday struggling to come to terms with the senseless death of their baseball player son in a random drive-by shooting by three teenagers in the United States. 22-year-old Australian Chris Lane was in the U.S. on a baseball scholarship. He was in Duncan, Oklahoma, and he'd gone running, because you want to stay, even in baseball, you want to stay in shape. He'd gone running. And this past Friday, three teenagers aged 15, 16, and 17 drove by him on the road. Danny Ford, chief of the Duncan Police Department, told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation he apparently was jogging. He went by a residence where these three boys were. They picked him up as a target. They went out and got in a vehicle and followed him. They come up from behind and basically shot him in the back with a small caliber weapon and then sped away. And left him to die on the side of the road. The story, we are told, has made headlines in Australia. The chief of police said that the teenagers had posted on Facebook that they wanted to go on a killing spree. And the police chief said, I think they were on a killing spree. We would have had more bodies that night if we didn't get them. One of the alleged teenagers had posted, bang, 2 drops in 2 hours. In Melbourne, Chris Lane's daddy said there's not going to be any good come out of this because it was just so senseless. There wasn't anything he did or could have done. He was an athlete going for a jog like he would do 5 or 6 days a week in terms of his training schedule. He was just a kid on the cusp of making his life. To try and understand it is a short way to insanity. Baseball Australia said it was shocked by the circumstances of Chris Lane's death. And I'm not being an ass when I say this. Why are you shocked? This is a brutal country. This is a bloody country. This is a country, a significant portion of whose population is more than happy to sacrifice the life of a 22-year-old aspiring baseball player because, you know, freedom and Second Amendment rights. Texas Betsy asking, shocked? Shocked? Why are they shocked? Shocked because he was a white kid? No. I think as far away as Australia, Betsy, they were shocked because it happened. Because I would dare say that this is absolutely almost 100% unthinkable in a place like Australia. It's certainly nearly 100% unthinkable in most other civilized countries. But it's not unthinkable here. Crap just happens. And you know, and you never know how or when or who. There's a million questions to be asked, one of which is, what are a 15, 16, and 17-year-old doing in possession of a firearm? Well, freedom. Protecting freedom. Unless you're 22-year-old Chris Lane, who wanted to play baseball, who wanted to see the lights in a big stadium, and hear 50,000 people chant his name. Just as boys have yearned to do for way over 100 years now. We export baseball to a country with a perfectly good rugby, soccer, and Australian rules football culture. And look what happens. The three teenagers will face the death penalty. Doesn't matter a good goddamn. Because guns are more important than human lives in the United States of ammunition. I mean, America. Well, so that's Moran Monday. By fits and starts for this Monday, the 19th of August, 2013. I hope we're here tomorrow. And if we are, well, Titanic Tuesday will unfold. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this happen. You with your kind contributions. And you who share your finite time to participate in the conversation in whatever way you do. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Sparky and Lottie and Betsy in the chat room. Thanks to John Fox in Australia. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and acheact.org. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you. And Rick Smith is up next on the Horn.